So we changed things up in the auditorium today. If you're not registered, a big hook will come down, grab thing will come down from the sky, and we'll pick you up and we'll put you outside. Okay, each week you check your name off on the roll sheet, which is printed. If your name isn't on the roll sheet, you find Lisa Draper or me, and you get a registration form, and then you register, and then your name will appear magically on the roll sheet. Okay, that's what we do each week. Second, thank you for efficiently reconfiguring the room. We moved all the chairs up so that you're not so far away from me sitting here, which is what I kind of have to do some today. Also, thank you for getting here on time, because we're going to start. Today we start at 10:18, right? We're going to start at 10:15, like maybe next week, maybe 10:16 next week. Speaking of next week, Mark McGinnis is going to come and we're going to interview him. Mark McGinnis is the person who founded the Environmental Defense Center, the Community Environmental Council. He was one of the people who started Earth Day. He is a professor at UCSB's Environmental Studies program. Pretty amazing dude, and he also is the guy who walks on stilts at the solstice parades. And before that, County Board of Supervisors, I guess. So let's see. So that's next week. There is no class on the week after that, which is Valentine's Day.
President's Day weekend, and Lincoln.
Yes, but it's also Valentine's Day. There's no class on the 14th, and then we resume again on the 21st. The reason there's no class on the 14th is because it's a weekend President's Day holiday.
Yeah, I keep Friday off.
Yeah, President.
Today was supposed to be Carl Blasey is talking to us about the placebo effect, especially as it is used in modern medicine, but he was called out of town unexpectedly, and so I put together a class in short order, very short order. I have no idea what we're going to do. No, I do. But we'll see if it flies, because it certainly hasn't been rehearsed.
What is the regular schedule
with him? Whenever he gets back in town, we will reschedule.
Oh, yeah, family emergency?
Just something called him out of town, and when he comes back, we'll
okay.
He'll work with us. Let's see. If you need, for summer classes, if you need assistance with fee-based classes, if you need a scholarship, that's what you do. Starting February 5th, you can get tuition assistance at the office, I guess,
or online.
Or online. And the information is there on the board, which is over there. Chuck Barris, are you here? Chuck? He's going to make an announcement. Chuck, are you here? No? Then it'll wait for next week. Let's see. Any other announcements, real quickly? Yeah.
I just wondered,
Carlene, right?
Carlene.
Yeah.
Hey, well, you have a good memory. The same old grind, those guys meet at the same old grind after this?
Oh, yes. Yeah, okay. So are people meeting at the daily grind today after this class?
Yes.
Dina and Anita? Yeah. Okay, so it's at the daily grind, which is De La Vina and Mission, right? Just a couple blocks away.
Can you just walk there?
Yeah, you just walk there from here. It's easy. It's 2 blocks.
Did somebody walk me there just for the first time?
Okay, Michael, the guy in the blue shirt, see that guy?
Yay! Okay.
So you don't turn the wrong way and go to the gas station instead. Dick.
Some of you don't know, but the last 7 years, last 8 years, I've been teaching a class at the Ridley Tree Crank Cancer Center for survivors of cancer. It's a meditation class and a teaching based a lot on the words of Carl's teachings, and it's been pretty well received. Why I'm offering this to you, because many of you either have friends, family members who have also survived of cancer, and it's a way of empowering them for the future and dealing with their own medical histories. Cancer is a very scary thing, for not only for those who haven't had it, but those who have and are concerned about empowering themselves, so decreasing the reoccurrence in their lives. And a lot of the works are done by Jon Kabat-Zinn, as well as a very intriguing research that Carl has proposed on telomeres and other things. So if you're interested, you can contact the Ridley Tree or me directly. It's 7 o'clock on Wednesday evenings at the Ridley Tree Conference Center.
So the Ridley Tree, is it at the Cancer Center? So it's at 7 o'clock on Wednesday evenings, and it's for any cancer survivor.
Right, only cancer survivors.
Okay. Not family members thereof.
No.
Okay.
It could be some caregivers, possibly.
Okay.
Cancer.
Could you say your name?
Richard Axelrod.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Dina.
Dina,
I'd like you to use this. Just come close to it.
Stand up.
Oh. Who would you like to call?
Okay, I started a group that's the theme is let's make a difference, like using spirituality in various areas of life. It could be politics, it could be medicine, it could be teaching, it could be in so many areas, and so it'll be. On February the 8th, Saturday, at 108 Northridge Road. And I think that it's to inspire people to do things after you've been inspired here. Mm-hmm. It's the idea is to do something and to get things started by making a difference.
What time on the
8th? 2:30 to 5. And it's just a new group. And we serve tea and cake or coffee and whatever. And just get ideas, for getting ideas for the community, for the world, for whatever.
Do you require a sign-in?
So it's a week from tomorrow. From 2:30 to 5 at 108 Northridge. And this is Dina Black, whom you can ask further about it if you wish.
It's actually a meetup group, so you can go online and find a meetup and formally sign up there. It's called Santa Barbara Spirituality Cafe. Is that right, Dina?
That's right.
Yes. Santa Barbara Spirituality Cafe.
Just put in Santa Barbara Spirituality Cafe. And there'll be everything in there. You can sign up, whatever.
Okay, so Gordon.
I know a lot of you are interested in climate change. They're going to have an important meeting February 5th at the Unitarian Church in Jefferson Hall. I think it's around 6:30 or 7 in the evening. I'm not so sure. But it's kind of interesting. There'll be several speakers there, and if you want to know more about climate change, I mean, that's what it is, I think.
Okay, so that's February 5th, which would be Wednesday.
Yeah.
Wednesday, February 5th at the Unitarian Church,
yeah.
The one downtown, I think.
Right.
Okay, so now we've got to do a bit of business. We're going to do a lot today, so we're going to go through this business real quickly. It's just obligatory business. I am going to pass out a syllabus to each of you. You will look it over very briefly because it's very brief and there's not a lot in it, but it's an official thing that I do. So, so I need some help with this. And E wants you pass it out to that side. Pass it out to the back side. And Leon, why don't you start from the back and pass it forward? And that should probably be enough. But oh well. Right. Everybody gets one of these. If you're extra, just pass them to the center aisle. We got one?
Thanks, Leon. Any? Thank you.
Your kid? Oh, nice.
All right, so just to tell you what's here and not here, I did not write almost all of this. It was all required. Too loud? Okay, how about that? Is that better? If it gets too loud, yell. So I didn't write most of this. It was just required, and it was written for me. The only thing, so the course description, unfortunately, I've been trying to get changed for 2 years because it's a really dull course description. It's the thing that goes in the catalog. But apparently, it takes years and years to get City College to do anything. Never mind, I didn't say that. So the course description is the course description because my course description I keep writing for them never kind of appears. Topics I wrote, class structure I wrote, everything else I did not write. Text material, notes, accommodations for students with disabilities, student learning outcomes. Those are just obligatory things that were written for me. The only one to pay attention to is accommodations for students with disabilities. If you need an accommodation to make it easier for you to be in this class, you contact ESPS and they help you. They will give you special furniture or other accommodations that you might need. Questions? Bernie?
Under course description, when you're making the changes, do you change older adult students to maturing?
I do that when I send this stuff out to you. Notice when I send the flyer out to you, it doesn't say older adults, it says for mature adults. I can do anything I want, but officially, I can't do anything. All right, so you saw this, okay? This is, I did my duty. They won't fire me. Okay. One further bit of business is, if you are registering, if you are not on the, everybody that pay attention, folks, especially people that are talking right now who are not registered. If you are not on the sign-in sheet, on the official course registry, you're not registered. You have to fill out a registration form. Be sure to put the course number on the back of it, 66015. And then you have to take it to the office. I cannot take the registration sheet to the office. Turns out you have to physically walk it over to the office right there. So please do that today if you are not registered, otherwise I have to chase you next week. Okay. All right, let's talk just a little bit about mindfulness and sit and then charge into our lessons for today. Today, I would suggest that you pay special attention to your feelings. How do you do that? Not by thinking about them necessarily, but by directly experiencing what you are feeling. Now, since when I tell people to do that, they say, I don't know, because they're so accustomed to thinking about what they're feeling and because their feelings aren't directly accessible to their awareness. Then what I tell people is, pay attention to what's going on in your body. To what's going on in here, what's going on here, what's going on throughout your body. And you will get a kind of physical sense of what's going on in your body, even though it's not like a normal physical sensation. It'll be kind of a vibration or a coloration or a flavoring or an energy kind of. And it might be very subtle, but if you just keep, as you're paying attention to your breathing, pay attention to your full body experience, as though your attention were coming from your whole body. So your whole body is what's paying attention. And you're paying attention to very subtle shifts in how your whole being feels. That's going to be important for the lesson that we're going to do today. So that doesn't mean you won't be thinking and you won't get lost in thought. And that doesn't mean you won't be preoccupied by sensations like hearing or itching or something else. But every once in a while when you're feeling your breathing and letting yourself soften and open and just relaxing and breathing and softening and opening so that you're a wide open awareness, you will notice something that is kind of a subtle influence on how you are at that moment. Now, there might also be very strong feelings, in which case you'll be able to notice them really quickly and really powerfully. But if not, there's kind of like an undercurrent of feeling. Try to tune into that undercurrent of feeling and see how it changes. If there are pronounced feelings, then you might want to inquire into them especially. For example, if you close your eyes and you sit and you get very sad, that doesn't mean there's something wrong with you. It's a very frequent experience that many of us have. The question is why that sadness is coming up, why it's so subtly pervasive. And so you might inquire into it by especially inviting it, especially paying attention to it, opening yourself to it, seeing if it gets more or less, seeing if any thoughts come along with it, seeing if it permutes into something else, so that you begin to understand why you're having these flavorings in your life. And of course, we'll talk more about that after we sit. So why don't we sit for 10 minutes? Your basic instruction is always the same. Feel yourself breathe, let yourself soften and open, and notice whatever is occurring. So again, this isn't thinking differently. It's simply tuning into what already exists. You're breathing because things in your body are moving as you breathe. The state of your body in terms of how physically tight it is or how soft and open it is. And whatever crosses your awareness.
Oh, that's self-holding. Give me a second. Good.
this morning is revisit a subject that we investigated a little bit last time, because I think it's so important. We'll do that for a little while, and then we'll move into a consideration of what emotions are and what to do about them. And that will be, I'll talk to you about that. And then the ending of the class will be a very good video about emotion. That's what we do. The first thing I'm going to do is read to you a statistic and then a short article, both of which were brought to my attention by Leon Juskalian. So,
are you going to mention the PE fund?
No, not this time. At some point, yeah, let's do that at some point. That will freak out everybody who's in the psychological and counseling professions, for sure. And everybody who's got a diagnosis, but we'll get there. Okay. All right, so just a very short statistic for you. Nearly a quarter of college students, nearly 25% of college students, were diagnosed with or treated for anxiety problems in the past year. One out of four was diagnosed with or treated for anxiety problems in the past year. And 20% of college students were diagnosed or treated for depression. Now that, how many actually have significant anxiety and depression is much more than that. These are the ones that were actually identified and treated. According to a spring survey of nearly 68,000 students by the American College Health Association, that's up from about 10% each for anxiety and depression in 2008. So from 10% to 25% and 20%, it's at least double the number of college students that are getting treated for anxiety and depression. So why might this be? We've talked some about this. Let me just talk a little more about it by reading an article written by, and this is from the Wall Street Journal recently, written by Mary Piper, P-I-P-H-E-R. Some of you might know of her. She wrote the book Reviving Ophelia, Saving the Cells of Adolescent Girls. Very well-received book. She's a very famous psychologist. And her daughter, Sarah Piper Gilliam, who is the editor-in-chief of Exchange, an international magazine for early childhood professionals. So it's a pretty high-powered article in a pretty high-powered newspaper. What are they saying? It's called The Lonely Burden of Today's Teenage Girls. Quote, I have friends with debilitating problems like cutting and OCD, end quote, a girl named Jordan recently told us. Quote, it's frustrating because I can't help them. I mean, I'm only 14 myself, end quote. Young Americans have become unwitting guinea pigs in today's huge, unplanned experiment with social media. And teenage girls like Jordan are bearing much of the brunt. In conversation after conversation, adolescent girls describe themselves as particularly vulnerable to the banes of our increasingly digital culture, with many of them struggling to manage the constant connectedness of social media. Their rising levels of anxiety and the intense emotions that have always been central to adolescence. Girls in 2019 tend to be risk-averse, focused on their studies and fond of their families. They are also experiencing high levels of depression and loneliness. A 2019 survey by the Pew Research Center found that 36% of girls report being extremely anxious every day. 36% are extremely anxious every day. They're particularly worried about school shootings, melting polar ice, and their ability to afford college. Over the past 18 months, we have conducted interviews and focus groups with around 100 American girls aged 12 to 19 and their mothers. Most of them Midwestern and middle class. We agreed to withhold their last names. We have also interviewed many more teachers and therapists around the country. That sample isn't comprehensive, of course, but the results are highly suggestive and strikingly consistent, with much to cheer about and also much to worry about. Many girls report that their mothers are their best friends. The close-knit family unit has, for the most part, rebounded as divorce rates have dropped to a 40-year low. But today's girls aren't as self-sufficient as their counterparts in earlier decades. They're less likely to possess a driver's license, work outside the home, or even date. They are also more solitary. Research from the University of Michigan's Monitoring the Future project shows that since 2007, the dawn of the smartphone era, girls have dramatically decreased the amount of time they spend shopping, seeing friends, or going to movies. We found that many girls spend their Saturday nights home alone, watching Netflix and surfing social media. The glow of screens is unavoidable. Last year, the Pew Research Center reported that 95% of American teenagers have access to smartphones. The nonprofit group Common Sense Media has found that contemporary teens spend 6 to 9 hours a day online, and that 72% of teens felt manipulated by tech companies into remaining constantly connected. Because of the omnipresent smartphone, girls can call or text their parents to ask what's for dinner or request a ride home. Many girls are rarely out in the world alone, solving problems by themselves. When girls do eventually leave home, they often find themselves ill-prepared to navigate real life. In 2011, the American College Health Association reported that 31% of female freshmen said they had experienced overwhelming anxiety or panic attacks. And by 2011, the American College Health Association reported that 31% of female freshmen said they had experienced overwhelming anxiety or panic attacks. By 2016, that number had shot up to 62%. 62% of college freshman women have experienced overwhelming anxiety or panic attacks in the past year. That's two-thirds, just a little under two-thirds. Quote, "When my friends are depressed, I'm the person they call," said Olivia, age 14. "It's terrifying. I put suicide prevention apps on so many people's phones," end quote. We are grateful for girls like Olivia who help their friends, but teenagers aren't ready to handle this level of emotional responsibility. How did we get here? According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, in 1993, girls scored the highest level of suicide ever recorded. From 1994 onward, rates of suicide steadily decreased until 2007, when they started to skyrocket. The American Association of Pediatrics now warns that too much social media use can lead to depression and anxiety. Social media works against basic developmental goals: physical, cognitive, relational, sexual, and maturational. Girls sleep with their phones and react to every notification. As they create more interesting, supposedly happier, virtual personas for themselves, their real selves diminish. Girls collect likes instead of making friends. They can be devastated by a cruel text or a tepid reaction to a selfie. Long before they hold hands with a date, they're exposed to online pornography and misogynistic messages. In a sense, modern girls are never truly alone and never truly with others. In a 2018 National Health Survey by Cigna, girls reported the highest levels of loneliness ever recorded. Quote, "Honestly, sometimes I wish we were living in the olden days, when kids hung out with friends and went out on dates," Genevieve, age 16, told us. "But that just isn't what my friends and I do," end quote. Many of the girls we interviewed, Many of the girls we interviewed articulated many of social media's drawbacks, even as they declared that they can't live without it. Quote, after an evening online, I go to bed feeling unhappy. Izzy, 13, told us. I wonder, what did I do all day long? Then I wake up and do the exact same thing the next day. This is all to point out, now this is about teenage girls, but it's all to point out that there's society is changing radically, and the youth are changing especially radically, and the agent of that change seems to be their interconnectedness, which would seem to be a good thing, but it's turning out to be a mixed blessing at very best. I think we need to kind of continue to monitor this, because we talked about this some years ago, but the situation is worsening. I mean, the statistics are continuing to climb radically, and they're not good statistics. And kids are spending, as we learned last week, are spending more and more time, even from 3 years ago, the amount of time they're spending online is like double. What was it, 52% of teenagers say they're online constantly or just about constantly? Bernie.
It seems like that we put an age limit on cigarettes, on alcohol, and drugs that you can't get to. Why can't we identify this as a same kind of problem and do something with the companies that create these phones where they have, for example, 2 hours a day and that's it, they blank out for 24 hours, or whatever it is. Treat it like it's a problem, like alcoholism or whatever, and approach it from that approach rather than how do we adjust to it.
It's a complicated answer to that question. I think that the general answer these days is it's going to be up to the families to regulate this.
Well, it wasn't up to the families to regulate cigarettes.
I understand.
And alcohol.
I can imagine the furor if the government said you can't turn on your phone more than a couple of hours a day, or you can't see certain things, etc. Anyway, it's a thought. A couple of comments, and then maybe three comments, and then we got to move on because I really have a huge lesson. So I'm going to take the microphone.
Well, the problem is that I believe it is up to the family, but it really gets deep when the family, one or the other, are just involved in their device as the child, and we keep hearing about this. But I would like to start hearing some solutions or some people that have tried different techniques and see how it works. We know it's out there and we discuss it, but it seems like that's all we're doing. We're just discussing it, and I haven't heard any kind of suggestions or anything.
Okay, so in terms of suggestions, Gene Twenge, who's a world expert on this at this point, came to Mind and Supermind and actually talked at the end of her talk on, she gave various suggestions. You can Google her, T-W-E-N-G-E, Gene is her first name, and I think that you can probably find her suggestions on her website.
Well, I wrote an article on EdHat.
Oh, okay. So where can we find that article? Is that?
If you go to EdHat, I don't have a comment to your question.
Okay, because you talked about it. Okay, so wait, I'm going
to
put the...
If you go to EdHat and you put my name in, it'll come up.
See what you can do, and we'll revisit this. Okay, we have two more comments, and then I've got to kind of cut it off, because I won't be able to, maybe three or four, and I won't be able to get where I'm going.
It seems that we're blaming the young people for this kind of problem, mainly. But I think we should also bear in mind that, the corporations have something to do with it. I don't know what the solution would be, but I think they should be regulated.
Well, that seems to be what's going to happen. And we're not blaming the kids. The kids are the victims.
I'm curious about
about the statistics, wondering how these numbers extrapolate to older demographics. Because I'm wondering if anxiety is equally increasing in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. It's not just the kids. And I'm also curious about if this is local or if it's particular to first world countries or how global this is.
First, in terms of is anxiety and depression increasing, what I remember from Jean Poinke's comments is not anywhere near like the extent that it's increasing in the young. What we see is when smartphones came in, and especially when most kids got them, that's when the incredible upspike happened. Of course, we all got them at that point, so the question is whether this is true for all of us. My impression is it's true for all of us, but it's much truer for the kids. It's a steeper increase in difficulty for the kids, because the kids are kind of more connected and more emotionally labile. And so the second question was, I know that in countries where a lot of people have smartphones and they're kind of developed countries, we see the same thing. There's all kinds of things that governments are doing to regulate this in places like Japan and China, especially Japan. But whether it's the case in countries that aren't yet developed, I don't know. I haven't seen anything about that. If I find it, I'll let you know. There were two more comments here, and then we got. I can't do it. I'm sorry. I'm going to cut off the discussion after two more comments, because otherwise I won't get the lesson in.
It's getting clearer and clearer to me that the current economic system that we have, that's extractive and profit based and is undermining our healthy development and values in every sector of society. It's the smartphones, it's buying, it's profit-based. And until we look at that, when we look at that, we will begin to have a healthier society as we change our extractive, direct exchange economic system to be more in alignment with nature, with nature's ways.
Okay, so if I can paraphrase what he says, she says the smartphone isn't the problem, it's a symptom.
That's right.
Of something deeper.
That's right.
Okay.
I'm not quite sure how to express this, but there's two characteristics. There's the problem of the individual, and there's the problem of the society, and they're both interactive. To address what you had mentioned earlier, what you're talking about as a problem is kind of a medical-based model for how you approach that problem. So defining anxiety, defining depression, defining how that is treated by the individual themselves in an anti-fragile way that provides for growth and healing is one approach, and part of that has to do with defining where or trying to source where the etiology of that disease is. And we've done that approach with several other things, one of which is cigarettes or alcoholism, addictions, other kinds of things. But that model has some limitations because there's some societal inputs. You have to look at the illness of the society and what systems you can put in place to address that. The problem of modernity and new technology is that it comes in for a purpose but has unintended consequences. Pointing at blame, whether it's corporational or not, or individual or not, is not always helpful as looking at what the etiology is and then what the solutions for that might be. And what the basis of those on the societal end, say corporation, I've heard a couple of times, what the ethos of corporations is and how they function and what is their ethics having to do with bottom line, which are not necessarily aligned with the individual ethics. So how do we take over control of that to improve those issues? Has to do with more not jumping to answers, but exploring the sources of those problems and which model or models we need to put those solutions into.
So that was a more elegant way to echo what Anish said, which is that the problem isn't small. The problem is the underpinning of the whole society. Is this accurate? And if you look at small solutions, you're not going to solve the problem, because what you really have to look at is where the whole, what's driving the whole complexion of life. Somewhat? Okay. All right. So you can iterate it as time goes on. All right, so I'm going to move us now. This is just an ongoing question we have and an ongoing concern that all of us have. I want to move to a consideration of emotion. This may not be the world's smoothest presentation because I've never given it before and I just drafted it. So I'll kind of stay close to script as I can. But I kind of want to talk to you about emotion. So the Western idea, the idea in our society that thoughts, feelings, body responses, and outward behaviors are different things has led to a confusion about the nature of emotion. As we don't know, our society and especially our psychology doesn't really understand what emotion is because of this fractionation of a human being into thoughts, feelings, body stuff, and behaviors. And we've evolved separate disciplines to study these various parts of ourselves. For example, cognitive psychology studies how we think. Psychodynamic and humanistic psychology sort of study how we feel. Biopsychology talks about what's going on inside our bodies that affects who we are. And behavioral psychology talks about how we externally behave. So this has led to an incomplete, fragmented understanding of the nature of our functioning as human beings, as we get this many-part idea of who we are. But there's a new integration emerging from neuroscience and evolutionary psychology. That new understanding is basically that we are an entire organism always reacting in a unified fashion, complete fashion, to our life situation. We are an entire organism always reacting in a unified fashion to our life situation. The name for this unified response that we are always making to our life situation is emotion. By the way, that's the only definition of emotion that I have ever seen. All the books that I've seen on emotion talk about emotion, but they never define it, including all my psych books, because there's no it's feeling, you know? I mean, it's circular definitions. So this is an actual definition of what emotion is, but it's a new definition, a unified response to our life situation. It always involves thoughts, feelings, internal body changes, and behaviors. It involves all those things, always. So wait a minute. What are these feelings that you just talked about? What's the difference between feeling and emotion? Our awareness, when we have it, of our unified response to every life situation is feeling. We always have this response to every life situation. That's emotion. But sometimes we're not aware of it. We're lost in thought. We're preoccupied by a sensation. Well, we're mostly lost in thought. We don't really know what our whole organism is doing. So we don't have feelings. When they get really strong, then we go, oh, I hear my heart pumping and I'm really, really worried. I must be anxious or something, you know? So when we're aware of this unified body response, then we call it a feeling. So feelings are our awareness of our emotions. Our emotions are always, our feelings are occasional. So why do we have these emotional shifts in response to our life situation? Why do we have this emotional life? For life, to stay alive, and to promote more life. So our basic motive is to stay alive and to help life become, stay alive. So I think we're biologically programmed for service. That is, we're biologically programmed to feel really fulfilled, really deeply good when we help life. Not only our life, but other people's life, lives in general. It's a basic motive that life moves through us. So, we're always shifting our entire organism's functioning in response to the current situation we're in order to best survive the next moments. In current psychological terms, we're prediction machines. As what we're doing at every moment is assessing the situation and then orienting our whole being to respond best to what we expect the next moment to be. Our brains, our big brains, have evolved to do this not only to the actual situations we're in, but also to the situations that we can imagine. So we're not only responding with our whole organism to what's happening right now, we're also responding to all the things that are on all the levels of our mind. For example, right now I'm responding to this situation. I'm trying to get all the subtle cues. Do they like it? Don't they like it? They're going to throw cabbages at me. Is the ceiling going to fall in? Is my voice too loud? You know, all this kind of stuff is moving me around. But at the same time, I'm wondering if Sophie's itching. Because she's got a hot spot, and it's really making her crazy. And so I'm, because I love my dog, you know, I'm really concerned about it. She's sitting there trying to rub her butt, you know. But, so the point is that we have all these levels of stuff, not only that, because we're smart, we can not only look at the real world and model it inside us, we can also model all sorts of other potential situations, and we're reacting just as if they were real. Whatever's on our mind, we totally react to as if it's real. So what that means is our emotions, our bodies, our whole being's setting itself is very complex. It's not like one thing, it's not like I'm sad or I'm happy. It's really a complex reaction that we're making, or a multimodal reaction, and it's permuting all the time. It's subtly shifting all the time. Now, sometimes we're not aware of any of this, but it's happening whether we're aware of it or not. So, how can we, is it possible to classify this constant shifting that's happening in our being? Are there basic emotions? Do you remember, those of you who took Psych 1, do you remember in the Psych 1 books, there were all these lists of basic emotions? Like in my current Psych book, there are 4 different lists of basic emotions. And they're all different. One list has 8, one list has 7, one list has 11, one list has 12. And some of the emotions recur from list to list. And other of the emotions are only on 1 or 2 of the lists. And they never tell us in the books which is the proper list. It's because, now these lists are made by smart people, they're just using different techniques to try to figure it out. For example, Paul Ekman is using facial expressions. And he analyzes facial expressions, and he finds out that there are 8 different basic facial expressions. And so he says there must be 8 different basic emotions. But other people have different ways of approaching this, and they come up with different numbers. These are all good attempts, but they're all failed attempts. Okay. We're not going to find out from any of these attempts what are the true basic emotions. So we now have a better basis for discovering our emotional basis, and that better basis is neuroscience. So it's very early days in neuroscience, but what have we learned so far? We have 2 basic emotions. Approach and avoid. Yes and no, happy and unhappy, opportunity and threat. Every creature that's alive has these two basic motivations, these two basic emotions. Approach that which supports life, escape that life, that which takes life. You see this in the very, very most primitive creatures, and you see it in plants as well as animals. In human beings, the brain has evolved two most basic circuits to approach opportunity and avoid threat. Those two basic circuits are the reward pathway in the limbic system in the middle of the brain, the dopamine pathway that says, yeah, I like that, go get some more of it, and the fight or flight mechanism in the thalamus, hippocampus, amygdala, sympathetic branch of the autonomic nervous system, adrenal glands, etc., which says, I don't like that, get the heck out of here. Okay. So those are the two, and these are in the, if we look at the brain as having three basic levels, the first level, the lowest level, has to do with just regulating the body, heartbeat, breathing, posture, things like that. The second level, the middle level here, the limbic system, has to do with motivation and emotion. And above that, the cerebral cortex has to do with thinking, figuring out how best to get our motivations achieved. So body functions, motivation and emotion, basic drives, and then figuring out how to do that. So our basic emotions are only two. Yes and no, approach and avoid. But as life has become more as brains and nervous systems have developed, and life has become more complex for those creatures, on top of these two basic mechanisms have evolved a whole lot of other circuits. So these are the secondary emotions built on top of the primary emotions. Because we're dealing with many more kinds of opportunities and threats than very, very less evolved animals. Okay. So this identification of particular brain pathways and capacities is certainly a work in progress. The answer to the question of which, The answer to the question of which are the are dis, of which are the answer to the question of which are the discrete secondary and tertiary emotions, second level and third level emotions, those that help us meet more and different kinds of opportunities and threats, will evolve as neuroscience does. So what we're going to find out is that on top of these two basic brain mechanisms for approach and avoid, there are a bunch of other circuits that have evolved that help us specifically approach various kinds of opportunities and avoid various kinds of threats. And then on top of those secondary mechanisms, there are tertiary mechanisms that have evolved that have more finely helped us to exactly approach and avoid. Understand? So there's two basics, then there's a bunch above, and then there's a bunch above that. And we're just kind of mapping them. But let's be brave and look at Betsy.
Well, Elizabeth Sitaris calls our brain second order evolutionary system because it's just yes, no, approach, avoid.
Yeah.
And our body a third order, the cells in our body a third order evolutionary system, like a rainforest, because there's yes, no, and maybe. And so the stem cells are something other than approach. They go towards need, right? I guess they are approaching, but they're going towards need. They're not going just willy-nilly, approach or void.
Right.
And the way to feel that is through sensation, which is the voice of the body, where the voice of the mind is thought. And so to have a relationship with sensation is a way to feel those other emotions.
Okay, I'm going to stay on script, but I understand that this is a very crude treatment I'm giving. She's going further. Okay. Okay, so let's look at an example of this, how the secondary emotions are built on top of the primary emotions, and especially what, how we now understand the basic happy emotions. It used to be until just very recently, for the negative emotions, we had some understanding of the discrete negative emotions, the things that are part of the avoid, the fight or flight system. Anger, fear, and sadness are fairly well understood in math, and they seem to be somewhat the same and somewhat different. They all involve getting away from threat, but there are different strategies for that. So there's kind of this, some of the second order negative ones. But happiness was a puzzle. People just said basic emotions, anger, fear, sadness, happiness. Like happiness was one thing. Maybe there's different kinds of happiness, like more happiness and less happiness. You know, mellow happiness and ecstasy, you know, very excited happiness. Maybe there was high energy and low energy happiness, but there was really no sense of the varieties of happiness that they existed until neuroscience. So let's look at what neuroscience currently understands as the varieties of approach of happiness. Pathways have evolved, that is, circuits in the brain have evolved to use the neurotransmitter serotonin. I got to tell you that all these neurotransmitters that I'm going to talk about, they don't just do one thing. Depending on where they're being used in the brain and nervous system and body, they do different things. This is just one use for these neurotransmitters, one set of circuits that use these neurotransmitters. But it's a more complicated. Neurotransmitters have multiple functions. So there are pathways in the brain that use serotonin that have to do with social status, dominance, and pride. Social status, dominance, and pride. That is, when these circuits are active, the animal feels confident that it can get the stuff of life. It can get the food it needs. And if there's going to be a contest with other animals about who's going to get most of that food, who's alpha here, the ones with more of that serotonin pathway active will be more confident in getting that food. They will feel more pride, more social status, more dominance. Oxytocin pathways. The oxytocin pathways, at least the ones I'm talking about, have to do with satiety and contentment, and also nurturing love. You know, oxytocin, they talk about it as the cuddle hormone. It's the one that, when it's a hormone, but when it's a neurotransmitter, it has to do with being motivated to care for others. And also satiety and contentment, to be content in caring for others. The opioid peptide pathways, also known as the endorphin pathways, having to do with liking and pleasure and attachment, love, and gratitude. That is, when you eat something that you like, not only does the dopamine circuit, the basic circuit for approach, get set off, but also the endorphins get released in these various pathways, and you go, it reinforces the feeling of liking. Attachment love means you're the one. And gratitude means gratitude. These things I'm telling you are like branches that are coming out from the central trunk of the reward pathway. The dopamine pathway is the central trunk is enthusiasm, motivation toward. That runs by dopamine, and off that come these pathways that we have mapped for particular varieties of approach. The basal ganglia and cannabinoid pathways, they have to do with amusement, humor, and play, which is why when people use cannabis, they tend to be laughing and playful. However, if you put too much of something exogenous in your brain, then what's endogenous in your brain will go away, as some of us certainly know. That is, if you take too much of it from outside, the brain forgets how to produce it from inside, and then when you don't take it from outside, it ain't there, and you get a deficit, which is unfortunately what a lot of people are going to find out. And then the testosterone pathway, which has to do with sexual desire, a particular kind of approach. But I presented it as though it's really discrete. These pathways are just kind of separate. But they actually intermingle. It's more complicated than that. So they actually form tertiary pathways where several of them cooperate to further fractionate happiness into more discrete emotions. So that's kind of a little academic. I just want to give you a feeling for how neuroscience is starting to authoritatively map what's going on inside us, and in a clear way, you know, that there are these circuits and there are therefore these capacities, and those are our basic emotions. But that's, again, that's really heady. I want to bring it back down to earth now, and I need to do it quickly. So I'm not going to have any comment about it because I don't have time. All right, so here we go. 10 lessons about what this neuroscience tells us. Okay, 10 lessons about the neuroscience of emotion in 5 minutes or less. One, we're always having full organism emotions. Can't avoid it. We're always having full organism emotions. Two, we're only aware of these conscious feelings when we pay attention to them. When we're not paying attention to our full organism response, we don't have conscious feelings. So we're only aware of these conscious feelings when we pay full attention. Three, all our feelings are there for good reason. All our feelings are there for good reason. There's no bad feelings. Unpleasant, maybe, but not bad. They all are there for a good reason. Four, they each tell us something about whether we're getting our basic needs met. They each tell us something about whether we're getting our basic needs met. Five, the basic needs are, I've gone through this before, so I'm going to go through it really quickly. The four basic needs, from my point of view and the Hindu chakra system point of view and Abraham Maslow's point of view, are health and safety, pleasure, selfhood, identity, autonomy, and ability. That is, the ability, the selfhood is the identity, the ability to know what your needs are, autonomy, the freedom to get those needs met, and ability, the capability of getting those needs met. All of that is selfhood, and then connection. So, four basic needs: health and safety, pleasure, selfhood, and connection. Six, we are happy or unhappy to the extent that we're meeting or not meeting our four basic needs. We're happy or unhappy to the extent that we're meeting or not meeting our basic needs. The kind and degree of happiness, how happy we are, and the kind of happiness we experience tells us the status of which needs are being fulfilled and which needs are unfulfilled. The kind and degree of happiness tells us the status of which needs are fulfilled and unfulfilled. Eight.
Wait. That was six.
No, six, we're happy or unhappy to the extent that we're getting our needs met.
Yeah.
Six is we're happy or unhappy to the extent that we're meeting or not meeting our needs. Seven is the kind and degree of happiness tells us the status of which needs are fulfilled or unfulfilled. Eight, we need to feel, learn from, and be motivated by all our feelings. We need to feel, learn from, and be motivated by all our feelings. None are worthless. Nine, we can evolve better strategies to meet unmet basic needs. We can evolve better strategies to meet unmet basic life needs. If we're not meeting our needs, our strategies aren't working. So we can evolve better strategies to meet unmet basic life needs. And 10, to the extent that we involve, to the extent that we evolve effective strategies, our needs and we will be satisfied, content, happy, and fulfilled. To the extent that we evolve effective strategies to meet our basic needs, our needs and we will be satisfied, content, happy, and fulfilled. But I don't want you to take my word for it. I want you to listen to a rather remarkable TED Talk, I think, which we're going to see right now, which will echo what I said. Well, won't echo it, but will be parallel to what I just said. Don't worry if you didn't get all 10 of those. I wrote them down, okay? And I'll probably change my mind tomorrow. Okay, so here we go. If there is time after this talk, then we'll have the discussion, but we need to make sure we got this in, and it just about fits. So, what we need is we need the place kind of closed up in terms of light, so I can... Susan David is a psychologist at Harvard Medical School, and this TED Talk she gave last year to the TEDx Women's Conference, and it has about 7 million views already. So here's Susan David talking about the gift and power of emotional courage.
Hello, everyone. So buona. In South Africa, where I come from, so buona is the Zulu word for hello. There's a beautiful and powerful intention behind the word because so buona literally translated means I see you, and by seeing you, I bring you into being. So beautiful. Imagine being greeted like that. But what does it take in the way we see ourselves, our thoughts, our emotions, and our stories that help us to thrive in an increasingly complex and fraught world? This crucial question has been at the center of my life's work, because how we deal with our inner world drives everything, every aspect of how we love, how we live, how we parent, and how we lead. the conventional view of emotions as good or bad, positive or negative, is rigid. And rigidity in the face of complexity is toxic. We need greater levels of emotional agility for true resilience and thriving. My journey with this calling began not in the hallowed halls of a university, but in the messy, tender business of life. I grew up in the white suburbs of apartheid South Africa, a country and community committed to not seeing, to denial. It's denial that makes 50 years of racist legislation possible, while people convince themselves that they are doing nothing wrong. And yet, I first learned of the destructive power of denial at a personal level before I understood what it was doing to the country of my birth. My father died on a Friday. He was 42 years old and I was 15. My mother whispered to me to go and say goodbye to my father before I went to school. So I put my backpack down and walked the passage that ran through to where the heart of our home, my father lay dying of cancer. His eyes were closed, but he knew I was there. In his presence, I had always felt seen. I told him I loved him, said goodbye, and headed off for my day. At school, I drifted from science to mathematics to history to biology as my father slipped from the world. From May to July to September to November, I went about with my usual smile. I didn't drop a single grade. When asked how I was doing, I would shrug and say, okay. I was praised for being strong. I was the master of being okay. But back home, we struggled. My father hadn't been able to keep his small business going during his illness. And my mother, Lauren, was grieving the love of her life, trying to raise three children, and the creditors were knocking. We felt as a family financially and emotionally ravaged. And I began to spiral down, isolated, fast. I started to use food to numb my pain, binging and purging, refusing to accept the full weight of my grief. No one knew, and in a culture that values relentless positivity, I thought that no one wanted to know. But one person did not buy into my story of triumph over grief. My eighth grade English teacher fixed me with burning blue eyes as she handed out blank notebooks. She said, write what you're feeling. Tell the truth. Write like nobody's reading. And just like that, I was invited to show up authentically to my grief and pain. It was a simple act, but nothing short of a revolution for me. It was this revolution that started in this blank notebook 30 years ago that shaped my life's work, the secret silent correspondence with myself. Like a gymnast, I started to move beyond the rigidity of denial into what I've now come to call emotional agility. Life's beauty is inseparable from its rigidity. We are young until we are not. We walk down the street sexy until one day we realize that we are unseen. We nag our children and one day realize that there is silence where that child once was, now making his or her way in the world. We are healthy until a diagnosis brings us to our knees. The only certainty is uncertainty, and yet we are not navigating frailty successfully or sustainably. The World Health Organization tells us that depression is now the single leading cause of disability globally, outstripping cancer, outstripping heart disease. And at a time of greater complexity, unprecedented technological, political, and economic change, we are seeing how people's tendency is more and more to lock down into rigid responses to their emotions. On the one hand, we might obsessively brood on our feelings, getting stuck inside our heads, hooked on being right, or victimized by our newsfeed. On the other, we might bottle our emotions, pushing them aside, and permitting only those emotions deemed legitimate. In a survey I recently conducted with over 70,000 people, I found that a third of us, a third, either judge ourselves for having so-called bad emotions, like sadness, anger, or even grief, or actively try to push aside these feelings. We do this not only to ourselves, but also to people we love, like our children. We may inadvertently shame them out of emotions seen as negative, jump to solution, and fail to help them to see these emotions as inherently valuable. Normal, natural emotions are now seen as good or bad. And being positive has become a new form of moral correctness. People with cancer are automatically told to just stay positive. Women to stop being so angry. And the list goes on. It's a tyranny. It's a tyranny of positivity. And it's cruel, unkind, and ineffective. And we do it ourselves, and we do it to others. If there's one common feature of brooding, bottling, or forced positivity, it's this. They are all rigid responses. And if there's a single lesson we can learn from the inevitable fall of apartheid, it is that rigid denial doesn't work. It's unsustainable for individuals, for families, for societies. And as we watch the ice caps melt, it is unsustainable for our planet. Research on emotional suppression shows that when emotions are pushed aside or ignored, they get stronger. Psychologists call this amplification, like that delicious chocolate cake in the refrigerator. The more you try to ignore it, the greater its hold on you. You might think you're in control of unwanted emotions when you ignore them, but in fact, they control you. Internal pain always comes out. Always. And who pays the price? We do. Our children, our colleagues, our communities. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not anti-happiness. I like being happy. I'm a pretty happy person. But when we push aside normal emotions to embrace false positivity, we lose our capacity to develop skills to deal with the world as it is, not as we wish it to be. I've had hundreds of people tell me what they don't want to feel. They say things like, I don't want to try because I don't want to feel disappointed. Or I just want this feeling to go away. I understand, I say to them, but you have deaf people's goals. Only deaf people never get unwanted or inconvenienced by their feelings. Only deaf people never get stressed, never get broken hearts, never experience the disappointment that comes with failure. Tough emotions are part of our contract with life. You don't get to have a meaningful career or raise a family or leave the world a better place without stress and discomfort. Discomfort is the price of admission to a meaningful life. So how do we begin to dismantle rigidity and embrace emotional agility? As that young schoolgirl, when I leaned into those blank pages, I started to do away with feelings of what I should be experiencing. And instead started to open my heart to what I did feel, pain and grief and loss and regret. Research now shows that the radical acceptance of all of our emotions, even the messy, difficult ones, is the cornerstone to resilience, thriving, and true, authentic happiness. But emotional agility is more than just an acceptance of emotions. We also know that accuracy matters. In my own research, I found that words are essential. We often use quick and easy labels to describe our feelings. I'm stressed is the most common one I hear. But there's a world of difference between stress and disappointment, or stress and that knowing dread of I'm in the wrong career. When we label our emotions accurately, we are more able to discern the precise cause of our feelings. And what scientists call the readiness potential in our brain is activated, allowing us to take concrete steps. But not just any steps, the right steps for us. Because our emotions are data. Our emotions contain flashing lights to things that we care about. We tend not to feel strong emotion to stuff that doesn't mean anything in our worlds. If you feel rage when you read the news, that rage is a signpost, perhaps, that you value equity and fairness, and an opportunity to take active steps to shape your life in that direction. When we are open to the difficult emotions, we are able to generate responses that are values aligned. But there's an important caveat. Emotions are data, they are not directives. We can show up to align our emotions for their values without needing to listen to them. Just like I can show up to my son in his frustration with his baby sister, but not endorse his idea that he gets to give her away to the first stranger he sees in a shopping mall. We own our emotions. They don't own us. When we internalize the difference between how I feel and all my wisdom and what I do in a values-aligned action, we generate the pathway to our best selves via our emotions. So what does this look like in practice? When you feel a strong, tough emotion, don't race for the emotional exits. Learn its contours. Show up to the journal of your heart. What is the emotion telling you? And try not to say, I am, as in I am angry or I am sad. When you say I am, it makes you sound as if you are the emotion. Whereas you are you, and the emotion is a data source. Instead, try to notice the feeling for what it is. I'm noticing that I'm feeling sad, or I'm noticing that I'm feeling angry. These are essential skills for us, our families, our communities. They're also critical to the workplace. In my research, when I looked at what helps people to bring the best of themselves to work, I found a powerful key contributor, individualized consideration. When people are allowed to feel their emotional truth, engagement, creativity, and innovation flourish in the organization. Diversity isn't just people, it's also what's inside people, including diversity of emotion. The most agile, resilient individuals, teams, organizations, families, communities are built on an openness to the normal human emotions. It's this that allows us to say, what is my emotion telling me? Which action will bring me towards my values, which will take me away from my values. Emotional agility is the ability to be with your emotions with curiosity, compassion, and especially the courage to take values-connected steps. When I was little, I would wake up at night terrified by the idea of death. My father would comfort me with soft pats and kisses, but he would never lie. We all die, Susie, he would say. It's normal to be scared. He didn't try to invent a buffer between me and reality. It took me a while to understand the power of how he guided me through those nights. What he showed me is that courage is not an absence of fear. Courage is fear walking. Neither of us knew that in 10 short years he would be gone. And the time for each of us is all too precious and all too brief. But when our moment comes to face our fragility in that ultimate time, it will ask us, are you agile? Are you agile? Let the moment be an unreserved yes. A yes born of a lifelong correspondence with your own heart. And in seeing yourself, because in seeing yourself, you are also able to see others too. The only sustainable way forward in a fragile, beautiful world. Sawubona, and thank you. Thank you.
All right. So if we can have a little bit of light, we'll have just like a couple minutes here. Look at this. Again, if you want to see that TED Talk again, her name is Susan David. And you just go to TED, and at the top where it says watch, you click on that, and it brings down a screen where you can put in the search thing, Susan David, and it will bring up her talk. Susan David. So in the next, we have 2 minutes. I guess the big take home from this whole thing is pay attention to your whole organism. And how you're feeling, and try to understand why those feelings are there and what they're telling you. What they're telling you you have or don't have, and what they're telling you about how to get it. So, questions or comments? Kim, Anit.
It's just real quick. We are energy, everything is energy, and emotion is energy in motion.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I love that definition. Energy. So, anybody else? All right, then you get out of here a minute early. How about that? We'll see you next. See you next week. If you aren't registered, please fill out a register.